I can be here really early. I like early.
Welcome to the Senate Committee on Education and Workforce Development. Well, winter is coming. This is the final meeting of this committee during the interim. And we will proceed today through the agenda in the order of the agenda. And then afterwards, we will introduce legislative concepts as draft legislation for the coming session. And we will spend some time on some of those bills, speaking to some of the people behind them, including some legislative council officials on one of them. So one of those bills that we will introduce bolsters Oregon's system of dual credits and accelerated learning in high schools, and that cues up our first presenter. Hilda Roselli, the Director of College and Career Readiness, is here to give us the task force, tell us what's in this legislation, which is a culmination of the committee that we created through Senate Bill 222 to try to get, with the goal of helping Oregon students earn more college credits in high school, to give them a head start on technical training and bachelor's degree and all those other things. So welcome, Hilda.
Thank you very much. For the record, my name is Hilda Roselli. I serve as the Director of College and Career Readiness with the Oregon Education Investment Board. And I'm here representing Chair Nancy Golden, who chaired the Senate Bill 222 Accelerated Learning Committee. One of the things that I shared with you the last time we were providing an update was that there was a very a systematic way of trying to translate what had been in the discussions of the committee throughout the year and resulted in a legislative report into a legislative concept. So I will update you on that. Wanted to just review briefly the committee members appointed by the governor, and that group met eight times this past year and used a goal and parameters around their work to define how they could build upon the success of a number of different efforts that are already underway in our state, and particularly to address opportunity gaps for students. In terms of the charge, just a review there, that it concluded with a legislative report that was turned in October 1st. In terms of terminology, just to refresh everyone's memory, we kept a broad, open attention to a variety of options, and particularly Senator Roblin, I remember some of your questions and concerns last time, and I'll share with you how that was addressed in the legislative report and in the LC Concept 274. Just as a reminder, we were very concerned about participation rates in remediation and trying to look at how this could address that. This is based on reports that we have analyzed from Ed Northwest. We also looked at data on our attendance and enrollment in AP courses and exams, and again feel like there's room for growth there, and also really looked at a lot of the research that reminded us that as few as six credits that students can take, college credits that students take while they're in high school, makes a notable difference in terms of students' ability to attain a college degree and obviously graduate from high school, thus addressing the 40-40-20 goal. We also have continually referenced the studies that were very specific to Oregon, done by the Oregon University system, that pointed out the benefits of dual credit. And we looked particularly at the fact that there are some benefits that extend beyond performance differences, particularly for students that may not have seen themselves as college going, that they are able to change their conceptions of their views about their future and the role that college may play as they pursue their career aspirations. As a quick reminder, these were the areas that we were trying to see as adjusted here through the committee's work, making sure that there was equitable access. Our estimates show that there are close to 200 high schools in Oregon that are not offering any dual credit courses and nor IB or AP coursework. There was a commitment to helping students that might not have taken any college-level coursework to try that out while they're in high school, experience what the rigor is like, and see that they may have very well a future in pursuing college after high school. Looking very closely at the equitable model, we now will be able to share with you some guidelines that are in the legislative concept around how we are proposing that the funds that were recommended to the governor would be distributed. And of course, a reminder that we want very much clear communication to students and their families. The goal that we were, that the committee was continually aiming to address was to make sure that every student in every high school student had access to at least 9 college credits at no cost. That's to assume that there will be costs for students that go beyond the first 9 credits. And as you have seen and received, there is a full legislative report, 32 pages, I believe, that have quite a few additional details, for example, around the reporting requirements. I'd like to shift now to really looking at, I'm going to move ahead here, a reminder that every intention of this work has been to ensure that there will be transferability of the courses that students take, and that there would be continued focus on the rigor of the courses to assure that they meet college expectations. And you'll see how that plays out in the funding mechanisms that are in the LC-274. There was discussion around priorities for these courses, and you'll see in the legislative concept that you have that those are now outlined as may include these courses. There was discussion about the need to consider a college success course, since that is acceptable for dual credit at the college level and may be a very appropriate first course for some students who may not have seen themselves as college going. It is available for the dual credit. There was discussion, and there's language in the LC-274 to address online course availability, particularly for our geographically isolated schools, with a caveat that there needs to be support for the student while they're in the high school setting enrolled in that online course. There was a reluctance to simply say, well, there's online courses available and the student is on their own to take those and to move through them successfully. In terms of financial support, there was attention to the fact that those first 3 courses for students would not have a cost to them. There was discussion about a shared responsibility model, and at this point it was felt, the committee felt that it was best to keep these 3 courses or 9 credits available at no cost. There was a recognition that the continued process of funding the high schools through the ADM would continue, and that the post-secondary partners would also receive some funding based on FTE that's generated, with the caveat that we know that in some cases community colleges that have reached their enrollment cap may not be able to realize any revenue from those additional FTE. What was new for this legislative concept was defining the floor and ceiling that would be negotiated between high school and post-secondary partners, with a recommendation of 15% and a ceiling of 90%, with the default being eliminated. It was really felt that that was not going to enhance the outcome. This slide outlines what is in the LC-274, the most recent copy that arrived last night, that really spells out additional funding that would be available to the districts. And the way I've tried to present this here is to make sure that we are clearly saying not only what are we trying to do, but what would the funds be used for. So first off, there would be an additional $20 per credit for the first 3 dual credit courses or AP IB courses that a student enrolls in while in high school. And those funds would be split evenly between the schools and the partnering university in the case of dual credit. And those credits would be, those funds would be specifically to help pay for the ongoing alignment of the courses that needs to be done involving high school instructors and their counterparts, faculty at community colleges or four-year institutions. It would also help with the costs that may be incurred around biennial reporting and would support some of the costs for textbooks for dual credit courses, as well as those student supports and advising. Because the intent was to close the opportunity gap for students that are traditionally underserved or underrepresented in higher ed, there was an additional $10 per credit for the first three courses that would be paid to the high schools. And there was a specific spelling out what those funds would be used for, primarily for developing courses that would give students an orientation to college if they've never really taken any dual credit courses, and providing those additional instructional supports that may be necessary, tutoring, mentoring, and also earlier exposure to the families of the benefits of this and advising around financial aid, etc. In addition, there was an additional $10 per credit for classes, the first three classes that students might take if it includes a CTE course, a career and technical ed course. This was in recognition of those ongoing rising costs of instructional materials and equipment replacement that career and technical courses often are dealing with. And lastly, there was an additional $20 per credit for any of the first three courses that included an AP or IB class, and that would help with defer of textbooks.
Hilda, Senator Roebling has a question on this slide.
You keep talking about per credit. Are we assuming that these are going to be three-credit courses so that at maximum would be nine? Because some kids would take a science class with a lab that might be a five-credit class. Are they going to get 15 credits in a year for their first three?
Because the committee had said nine credits or three courses, I think that's the level of interpretation that exists right now.
So right now you think nine would be probably the maximum, not the 15, even though three courses might be 15 credits?
That's true. I think biology may be one
exactly.
of those exceptions
there
for the lab. And so that certainly is something that we'll have to continue to look at closely to figure out what happens if it's 15 credits. But at least this gives
okay.
you
at
the
least
first
the
nine.
That's what I am.
Yeah.
And that's kind of when we switched to credits per course as opposed to the nine, I just wanted to understand that.
And the language in the LC indicates or. Three credits or nine.
And that's why I thought it could be as much as 15, which is $300 instead of the $100.
We could revisit that language and see
just
if
so you know when
that.
You're figuring it out.
In addition, as you may recall, there was a lot of discussion around instructor qualifications and the dearth of high school instructors that may be available to teach the courses if there is not a college faculty member involved. And the legislative report and the LC-274 still includes references to the kinds of change and movement that the committee felt was very important. One is that there may be a way to look at selected courses in that 100 level band that would be included in this that would have unique criteria for instructors. We found that is already the case, at least at PCC, where there is a difference in the instructor qualifications for somebody teaching selected 100 classes versus 200 level classes. We know already that exists for the career and technical education instructor qualifications, and for the college success course, there are very different criteria that do not require a master's degree. There was also a call out to the concerns that were raised by many of the school districts around the need for a streamlined application process for timelines that really consider scheduling of classes and consistency in approvals across campuses. If the same person is applying to more than one campus, it seemed logical that the results would be the same for both applications. And lastly, a call out to the need for coordination across our four-year institutions to provide online graduate classes in content areas to continue to enhance the capabilities and qualifications of high school teachers to be qualified to teach those classes under the traditional regulations. We have some concerns that as we see more and more initial licensure programs being at the undergraduate level, while that is very good and it helps increase our qualified pool of teachers, it may mean that you have fewer people, as we've already seen with MATs, that are not graduating with a master's in a content area. And so there may need to be coordination around online classes that would allow teachers anywhere in the state to actually acquire those additional credits. And the legislative concept 274 still holds what used to be called the accelerated credit account, I think that's right, and now it's referred to as the supplemental account, that allows grants and funds to be available to school districts that are trying to pay for some of those courses for their high school teachers. It allows up to one-third of the cost of the tuition. In terms of the last piece here, I just wanted to remind you that the appendix in the full legislative report outlines the types of outcome data that are suggested for monitoring and reporting back results to you, to the governor, and to the State Board of Ed and the Higher Ed Coordinating Commission. And right now, in the legislative concept, that's assigned a responsibility for the Higher Ed Coordinating Commission to oversee that process and make sure that the existing dual credit oversight rules apply as need be, and also that those reports are generated with as least amount of additional time-consuming tasks as possible. And lastly, that the Higher Ed Coordinating Commission would continue to make sure that this sustained collaboration ensures the level of course rigor that is expected of courses that are going to generate college credit. So where this lies now is you should have received the last version of the LC-274, there is a placeholder in the governor's recommended budget for $15 million that is labeled as accelerated learning. And I'm more than happy to take any questions that you may have for either Chair Golden or the questions that we may be able to answer for you today.
Well, thank you for that briefing. The report itself is on OLIS.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
And available for anyone. Our task force met a lot last year. We went through this, and I believe with all my heart that the lowest hanging fruit in education today is ramping up the amount of credits that kids in high school can earn, and that is a one of the many easy avenues to get toward 40-40-20. And I very much thank you for your leadership, Hilda, along with Dr. Golden. Also, I want to point out that we took some votes, unlike a lot of task forces. We took votes in there, and the vote on this recommendation that she just presented and the accompanying legislation was unanimous. So do we have any questions of Hilda here?
Comment. I do want to say thank you for the using college credit as the defining deal works better than mixing them up. Because like nine credits, college credits is basically one credit for a high school credit, and we don't get into this 3 and 9, figuring out what they are, but keeping it at the college is nice. The only concern I have is that we don't have a lot of semester credit institutions, but there are ones out there who our kids take classes from, and converting those is a little harder because we get
confused.
But I really appreciate that the 9 and the 3 makes it much easier to have a common knowledge, because we ran into that problem last time in the session, trying to figure out how to put it in high school statutes, what the credits meant, as opposed to the others. And I...
Well, that was one of 100 little problems we had in 2013 that told us that we couldn't do this in one session. And
right.
So the task force and so
on. This is really good.
This is what we ended up with. So hopefully this learning curve is we're on the other side of it now. And
the only other one I would say is that the, and it goes back to one that I asked you to consider, and that is when you take AP courses, we should tie that to Oregon's colleges and universities. Every university gives different credits for courses. So I get a 5 or a 4, and I go to USC, and my kids come out with, oh, wow, my one U.S. history case is giving me 15 credits as opposed to 3 that somebody else is getting because I got a high enough score. So when you're giving money back to the school based on credits earned, AP and some of those others have a different relationship with respect to the credits. So I would try to figure out how to keep it at 9, because kids who do well on AP courses can end up with more credits when they go to colleges than kids who get a little bit slower score on that same AP score. So, and institution vary what they're going to grant you on those AP courses. So I would figure out something in AP where you're going to give X number of dollars for an AP course successfully, as opposed to doing the credit thing, because they're going to come back and say, look, I just got 15 credits. Where's my extra money? Let's keep it consistent that if you take an AP course in a high school setting, you're going to get up to $20 times 3 or whatever. I just warned, because I was one of those same high school kids that any time I could get a break to give me a little better advantage, I'd find it. And some of the kids are better at that than I was. So just to encourage you to keep something so that you don't get into that fight at some point in the future.
Chair Haas and Senator Roblin and members of the committee, I think that might be able to be addressed with a simple wording of enrolled in.
Right. I agree with
because
that.
Those credits aren't earned until much later.
Exactly.
Okay. Other questions? All right. So we have this bill that will be a Senate bill. Senate Committee on Education, likely referred to the Senate Committee on Education, where we can refine it, maybe touch up some of these issues, and should the committee give it favorable consideration, it will likely be referred to Ways and Means. It has a $15 million price tag that is already included in the governor's budget. And I just want to say thank you for your help during this past year, Hilda. You were great.
It was an honor. Thank you.
Strengthening Oregon School Leadership, we have some presenters here on a concept. I'd like to call up Frank Carpolo, Krista Parent, and Aiden Udasenada. I did my best.
Not bad.
Thanks.
Ethan Udasenada.
He did it easier.
Not really,
did.
Wasn't very good. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Haas, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Frank Carpolo. I'm the Vice President of Education Policy at the Chalkboard Project. Before joining Chalkboard, I've served as a teacher, school principal, and assistant superintendent in Oregon and the North Sandiam and Albany school districts. Today, we are here to showcase the recent release of the report of the Distinguished Leaders Council and the two projects that we are beginning as a result of their report. The first designed to support current school and district leaders, and then a second for those who aspire to become school principals. The Distinguished Leaders Council was formed about a year ago by the Chalkboard Project, bringing together some of the state's most accomplished superintendents, principals, and one teacher with the charge to explore deeply the questions of how to rethink the role of the school principal, as well as how to rethink the way we train new principals, with the goals of closing achievement gaps for all students in Oregon. Chalkboard's mission is to help lift Oregon's K-12 schools to among the top 10 in the nation, and to help close achievement gaps and opportunity gaps between more and less privileged populations. We know that gaps are closing where strong leadership exists. With me today are two members of the Distinguished Leaders Council, Krista Parent, the superintendent of the South Lane School District, and Ethan Udo Sanatha, principal of Cottage Grove High School in the South Lane School District. Krista has been a teacher, assistant principal, principal, central office administrator, and is the current superintendent of the South Lane School District. Krista was named the Oregon Superintendent of the Year and the National Superintendent of the Year. She has served as the chair of the Chalkboard's Distinguished Leaders Council and will discuss the council's recommendations. Ethan is in his second year as the principal of Cottage Grove High School, one of only four comprehensive high schools to earn a level 5 rating. Ethan has served as a high school teacher and assistant principal in other districts as well. Like Chalkboard's other project initiatives, Class and Teach Oregon, we expect this focus on school and district leadership will lead to policy proposals, and as such, we want to keep you informed of our work. To be clear, we're not seeking legislation at this time, though the governor has included some investment dollars in his proposed budget that we support. We have a few slides that we'd like to show you, and then a few closing remarks, and we'd be happy to take questions.
So the council started out by reading volumes of research and studies on leadership, and much of the work that
could you start off by IDing yourself? Thank you.
Oh, I'm sorry. Krista Parent, Superintendent, South Lane School District. I also chaired the Distinguished Leaders Council. So the council started out by reading volumes of research and studies on leadership, and much of the work that we looked at was fairly new within the last 1 to 5 years. One of the issues that immediately jumped out at us was the principal turnover rate, and up here on the screen we have some of the statistics that we were looking at and felt were particularly alarming. We wanted to point out that the very last bullet on this slide looked at the TEL survey results, which educators across Oregon took last spring. And one of the key factors for staying at a school, according to teachers, was the quality of leadership at that particular school. So this jumped out at us right away. Principal turnover is a huge issue. The average life of a principal is somewhere around 3 to 6 years, and we know that education initiatives take at least that long to really take hold. And so we thought this was interesting, and we wanted to make sure that this was looked at deeply as we got to our recommendations. Consistent across everything we read was that mentoring and on-the-job experiences were viewed as far more valuable than graduate school coursework. And I think this slide shows that very well. And there was no difference between superintendents and principals. They felt the same way about this. And we thought that this was another issue that we wanted to pay close attention to. The council spent considerable time looking at the qualities of effective school and district leaders, and what you see inside the box here were the qualities consistent with high levels of student achievement. In a little bit, Ethan's going to talk to you about the day in the life of a high school principal and how these qualities play out in his work and where he has to really focus his attention to get all kids reaching high qualities and levels of performance. So we had some key takeaways after about 8 months, you know, things like one size doesn't fit all in terms of preparation programs. Right now in Oregon, there is one model for an administrative license. Everybody goes through that same model, whether you're aspiring to be a superintendent or a dean of students. Right now, programs admit nearly everyone. The data is really limited, especially in Oregon. There isn't a lot of information about retention rates, where leaders are going, how successful they're being. I mean, we saw that as a major problem. We also found out very quickly that there's a growing national movement looking at school and district leaders. There are a lot of dollars being invested in this issue. It's kind of been the missing link. A lot of focus has been on teacher effectiveness and not a lot of attention paid to at least district level effectiveness, but even not much paid to principal effectiveness. And that we also realized quickly that the racial, ethnic, and gender makeup of Oregon administrators does not mirror what Oregon students look like right now.
So the DLC ended up with 6 recommendations, 3 for how do we support the current school and district leaders who are out there now in our system, and also 3 for how do we prepare new administrators. These were the recommendations. And it really focused on that level of support that school principals needed. The DLC also quickly realized that a strategy to get to every principal was not going to create capacity in the system. So the work that we developed to start programs is focused on the central office for current district leaders, the program in green. And what we are planning is a program beginning in January, partnering with the Center for Educational Leadership. And what this program will do is focus on superintendents and executive level district office staff who supervise and support principals. The goal being to increase the capacity at the central office to support the work that principals need to do that was inside that box. Oftentimes, the urgent overwhelms the important in the life of a principal. And we know that in order to get all students to successfully complete high school, we need principals that are able to do both and focus on that instructional piece. For the aspiring leaders, those are currently teachers who are interested in becoming school principals. We believe that we can redesign the initial administrative preparation with the goal of giving all of those candidates who will participate an opportunity for a half-time release from their teaching duties in order to actually shadow successful principals. A year-long half-time residency program would give those candidates much more experience before they're handed the keys to their school.
So the council really wanted to look at a way that we could address existing leaders across the state in all regions of the state fairly quickly. And our goal originally was to look at a 4 to 5 year cohort model that would admit 50 applicants each year over that course of time. And by the end of 4 to 5 years, we would have impacted every school district in the state of Oregon. We initially looked at a variety of partners and landed on the Center for Educational Leadership out of the University of Washington. They've done some incredible work on this issue. They're working with state departments of education across the country to try to raise the quality of district level leadership in order to have more effective principals in all of our schools. And so we landed on CEL as our partner, and we're about to launch our first cohort on January 9th and 10th of this year. We took applications and we were going to limit it to 50, and we couldn't limit it to 50. We decided to take everybody that applied, that qualified, and so we'll have 71 participants in this first cohort, and it will be an 18-month cohort. Here's a little bit of the demographics about these 71 participants. 10% are participants of color, and currently 10% of administrators in Oregon are people of color. We have 33 superintendents. Most all of the large school districts in the state of Oregon are in this first cohort. We have 29 central office directors ranging from curriculum, special ed, and different levels of programming, and 8 HR directors, and we have 1 high school principal. This represents over 230,000 students by those districts. 40% of those students are students of color. We have 48 focus or priority schools that are represented in this first cohort, and 32 of these applicants also have pre-K programs, which is something that we want to talk about in terms of effective district leadership and how to incorporate our early learning initiative into our K-12 focused work. I just wanted to say, too, that Chalkboard's efforts around establishing this Distinguished Leaders Council, we're really addressing the need for a system change in Oregon. You know, we can't continue to look at finding the superstar principal that we can take and plop into a struggling school. We have to develop capacity within our system, and we think by this model impacting every school district in the state of Oregon in a fairly short period of time and raising the quality of district leadership will help us address things like school turnarounds in our priority and focus level schools.
The program that we are in the process of designing for aspiring leaders, we are currently seeking a partnership with an Oregon university or program that provides licensure for initial administrators with the goal of redesigning the coursework around the items and areas that principals and superintendents identify are most critical, partnering with them for that halftime release to guarantee meaningful experience, and then using our existing leaders network to support and mentor them in their first 3 years. This work to date has been funded by the Foundations for a Better Oregon with an investment of $500,000 to support the first cohort of the current school leaders program in the research and development phase for our aspiring leaders. our board has recognized that this is a critical piece. After we started looking at the importance of teachers in the classroom, we know that an effective school principal is the second factor that leads to student achievement. And we believe that having an effective classroom teacher working in tandem with effective school principals and supported by district leadership is a leverage multiplier for school effectiveness. I'm going to turn it over to Ethan to talk a little bit about his experience as a school principal and the importance of having a central office administrator that gets what his work is and pushes him to continue to do great work. And then we'll be happy to take questions.
So my name is Ethan Udo-Sinata. I'm the principal of Cottage Grove High School in South Lane School District. I want to thank you for having us and hearing us today. I actually want to start by telling you about some of the challenges of being a high school principal, but I want to start by telling you about when I first got hired as a principal. So when I first, I come from a working class family in North Eugene, and not a lot of my family members know a lot about education. And so when I called my mom and said, hey, you know, I got hired as an assistant principal, and she goes, what's that? And I said, you know, it's the person that helps the principal. She goes, they need someone that helps the principal these days? And I said, yeah, Mom, remember I was in their office all the time. and then my sister said, what exactly do you do as principal later on when I was hired as a principal? So you sit around the hallway and tell kids to get the class and to pull their pants up and wear their books? I said, yeah, I do that, you know, and I do some other things too. And so, you know, they had a fairly simple view and a misunderstanding of what the day in the life of a principal is and what the responsibilities of principals are. And that's fine because they trust that the principal is going to get the job done and that kids are going to leave school learning and the system's worked for them. When I became a principal, I also had a misunderstanding, and I was an educator, of what it took to be a successful principal. You know, I misunderstood the amount of time that it took, the responsibility, the amount of guidance that you needed, and the amount of support that you needed. So, you know, I wake up, let me tell you about my day. You know, I wake up, I try to get up at about 5 and get a workout in because it's really important to stay healthy. So I get up, I get my workout in. By 6:30, I'm checking emails because as a principal, you can only get emails done. You can only go without interruptions for more than 2 minutes. And I know several of you know this, having worked in the school before, before 7 o'clock. But from about 7 o'clock or 7:30 to about 3:30, the majority of my time is spent on the outside of that box that you saw. Where I'm dealing with, I'm dealing with facility management, student discipline, talking to parents, working with staff, and things come up in a school that you don't normally get trained for when you're in an administrative licensure program. 80% of your time becomes that, and 20% of your time becomes the stuff in the middle. And what's one way that I've really been supported is I've been fortunate enough to have a really good mentor in Krista Parent. And when I was becoming a principal, I worked with Colt Gill, and I also worked with Nancy Golden. And so, you know, those mentors really helped me fly my helicopter higher when I got inundated with the day-to-day stuff, because the day-to-day stuff never ends. And so, you know, for somebody like me, I typically put in anywhere between 60 hours a week and 80 hours a week, you know, during basketball season, especially if we're making a deep run in the playoffs, right? So I think it's really important if I were to go back, or if I had a say in my education or training as a principal, to focus on helping somebody like me get additional mentor support, very specific training on how to have a balance. And I think that this program, the Chalkboard, achieves that for aspiring administrators. But more importantly, I think it's important that once we become administrators, we don't get burnt out in 3 to 5 years. Because the data shows that it's really important if you're going to create good change and show leadership or have good results and achievement, that a leader needs to stick around for more than 5 years. And so I think by having a mentor and having a support system in place and having somebody that helps you see the bigger picture, that would help somebody like me really, really thrive in the position that I'm in. And I think that this program really achieves that.
We'd be happy to take some questions.
Thank you for that. I don't think anybody really up here disagrees with much of what you said. Can you tell us about the logistics of how this works, the grants, how to, what the participation is like? And
sure. So for our current leaders program, there is no cost for the participants. It's being fully funded by the foundations for this first cohort. They will meet about the first 2 days are in January, then after that about 1 day a month. And most of the sessions will be, well, I'd say in the first year, most of the sessions are full seminar sessions where they're learning about the theory of action, learning about what the work looks like. There are then, as we move into the second year and later into the first year even, the group, that whole group of 71 breaks up into four smaller cohorts where they are meeting with an instructor at a school site. And that is to actually model what the work looks like if you are a central office administrator and you are supervising a principal. What does that look like? What should that look like so that you know what's going on? That training is never provided. When I moved from my school principal role to the central office role, there wasn't a model for that. We had to create that model ourselves. And I think the effective central office administrators around the state are doing the same thing. What does that work look like when you go to a school and start to evaluate the effectiveness of the school principal? And also, how do you support and turn that into a coaching relationship so you can build their skills in the current situation that they're in? So that cohort goes for 18 months. The new leaders model that we are developing is really right now we're on the front end of an R&D process. We believe that the core elements of the of a redesigned initial administrative licensure program need to focus on intentional recruitment and selection, coursework that is relevant, a halftime release to enable the principal to the candidate to have real experience in what it means to lead a school. My personal experience, I did my 360 hours outside of my full-time teaching day, so I got to do lots of supervision at the basketball games. I didn't get into classrooms very much because I was teaching full-time, and I think that that's a pretty common experience. We need to shift that so that when I was handed the keys to my school, I had 2 days of experience in leading a school during my practicum program. We can do better than that. There are models around the country that are doing better than that, so that when a school leader takes over, they have the experience and they have the network and support in order to effectively lead schools. So we are in the process of developing out that work right now.
Well, I very much agree with a statement you said earlier that the without that kind of more thoughtful, guided training, that the urgent overwhelms the important. It's easy to fall into that. We're familiar with that dynamic up here, believe me. And it would be nice if the system could change to keep that that sort of guidance and compass.
I used to, in my school, as an elementary school principal for 7 years, kids left my school reading. In 7 years, I never taught a single student to read. My role as principal was to support my teachers to enable them to do that work. If I wasn't able to focus them and sometimes push them to do the work that needed to be done, that would have been, in my opinion, negligence for my students. That's the work that needs to be done. And we need our central office administrators who can then push and support the principals to see and do that work and get out of the urgent and into the important. Thank you.
Any other questions, comments, Senator
Byer? Just a question. You referenced that the average term of a principal was 3 to 5 years. Is that at a school or in terms of that's how long they're a principal and then they do something else?
That's at a school.
At a school. And I've watched that in the school districts where I live. And it seems like they get promoted out to another school or they go to the central administration. Is your point that they need to stay there longer?
Absolutely. Okay. Yeah, I mean, and you're talking to somebody who's been in the same district for 30 years, right. So I'm a little bit unique. But it's true for the superintendency, too. I think the average stay for a superintendent is right at 3 years. And, you know, this is hard, intense work. It takes a lot of time and trust building and collaboration that has to go on, and that's hard to establish short of 3 years. Just about the time, and Senator Roblin knows this from his work in Marshfield, but just about the time you get things going, then you have a major change, and, you know, the wheels fall off and you kind of start over again, and we need to build that stability and consistency for our kids.
It's hard to get anything changed in 3 years.
Yeah, it really is.
Senator Roblin?
And I really commend what's going on with Jock Board. I've been a firm believer that, and I know that my career was helped because of what COSA had a long-standing program with the Department of Ed where they did leadership training, and to me that was very helpful. The thing that I think people don't understand is if they train you well to handle the urgent stuff, which they don't. I mean, we don't get much of that at all in the education deal. But if you get that so that you feel comfortable with that, then while you're in the midst of it, you can use the middle stuff and actually use those opportunities to do it at a higher level with parents, with teachers, with students. But if you don't, if your brain hasn't figured out how to do all these other things almost automatically, because a lot of those are very automatic stuff, you never get to the other stuff. And it's really nice, the model you have. I commend you on what you're doing. And I have said that most of the research that I've done, that the single most important person oftentimes in a school district is the principal, because they keep the teachers. Your teachers stay with you for a long time. If you have the ability to do those kinds of things, they can create that kind of atmosphere that allows for it. And I hope that this continues and that there's things that we can do to help, because it's one of the places where I think we've done the least over the years in recognizing if you really want this whole system to work, what you have to do. So, and thanks for being at Cottage Grove and having some of my old students that work for you. I think you have a football coach and a bunch of others that are old Marshfield kids. So.
Thank you.
We do appreciate that. So, and it's always been fun to work with Cottage Grove. And Krista, who's been in this longer than I now, so it's pretty amazing, actually.
And just so you know, your Marshfield Pirates beat up on our Cottage Grove Lions last night.
Well, thank you, and please convey our deep appreciation to your foundation for continuing this good work, and hopefully it can be built upon down the road. And best of luck to the Cottage Grove Huskies.
Lions, yeah.
Lions.
Thank you.
Lions.
Thank you.
Appreciate your time.
We have spent a great deal of time on in front of this committee on the small schools, and today we're going to look at some of the challenges facing large schools. They're different, but nonetheless, they're challenges that a lot of people from small schools might not appreciate. So if I could bring up Bobby Regan, Leanne Larson, and I'm not sure if Jim Green is here.
Yep.
Come on up. There he is.
Chair House, members of the committee, I'm Bobby Regan. I'm a member of the Portland School Board, which currently has 48,000 students, and we're growing by about 600 students a year. I'm also president-elect of the Oregon School Boards Association, and I'm a recent governor appointee to the State School Funding Task Force. I'm pleased to testify today with representatives of the next two largest districts, Salem and Beaverton. Together, we represent 125,000 of the state's 550,000 students, and so individually and collectively, these students represent the promise of Oregon. In the last 4 years, Portland Public Schools raised its graduation rate 14%, and we hope to beat the state's graduation rate when our results from the class of 2014 are in. To continue this momentum, we need a significant additional state investment in our children. We look forward to the day when Oregon won't have one of the shortest school years in the nation, some of the largest class sizes, and the second to last graduation rate in the country. I'd like to address three significant investment opportunities that you could make during the next session, partnering with us to greatly support students in Portland Public Schools and in Oregon. So first, please provide stronger state reimbursement of expenses related to high-cost special ed students. The State School Fund Task Force recently recommended that the legislature reimburse 80% rather than 40% of costs over $30,000 per student. Families move to Portland and to other larger cities due to the myriad of services that they can access to support their severely disabled kids. These are Oregon students, and we want to serve them well. But the expense of this service shouldn't fall disproportionately on a few school districts which happen to be near hospitals and service centers. Serving even one of these students might prove a significant financial burden for a small district. In Portland, we serve approximately 350 students in this high-cost disability category. Please partner with us. Second, please make an additional investment to support our emerging bilingual students above and beyond what's currently allocated in the State School Fund. Of Portland's 48,000 students, about 8% or 3,800 are emerging bilingual. Taken together, our emerging bilingual students would be the 41st largest school district in Oregon, or bigger than the Silver Falls School District. While 70 languages and dialects are represented, our top 10 languages are Spanish, Vietnamese, Chinese, Somali, Russian, Maymay, Arabic, Karen, Chuuk, and Hmong. We're also seeing increasing numbers of refugee students arriving at our schools with little to no formal education and significant social, emotional, academic, and linguistic needs. To best serve our emerging bilingual students, Portland Public Schools is expanding our language immersion programs, currently offering 10 Spanish immersion programs, 2 Mandarin programs, and one program each in Japanese, Russian, French, and Vietnamese. We're looking to offer Somali in the near future. To do so requires additional expenses related to teacher recruitment, family engagement, curriculum, translation, and library resources. Please partner with us. Finally, please follow the lead of many other states and pass legislation to provide matching funds to school districts when their communities approve local capital facilities bonds. Each of the big three districts have passed local facilities bonds recently. Our communities are with us. But without a state match, progress is very slow. Portland's recent $482 million bond is financing the full remodel of 3 high schools and the replacement of 1 K-8 school, along with re-roofing, seismic and accessibility work, and science labs in as many as 63 of our school buildings. To remodel our entire inventory of 78 schools, which on average are over 65 years old, will take about 32 years. We expect to go out for another bond in 2016, layering it on top of our first. It would be a welcome investment as we make this difficult ask of our community and as smaller districts are contemplating their capital needs. As we implement our bonds, the state benefits greatly from increased job creation and increased income taxes. Please partner with us.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Jim Green here today representing the Salem-Keizer School District. Many of you know me from the Oregon School Boards Association, but I am a locally elected school board member on the second largest school district in the state, and I am the thorn between two roses today. I am neither Christy Perry, our new superintendent, nor Nancy McMorris Oddix. Neither of them could be here. Nancy's actually delivering a baby this morning and called me last night at midnight and said, can you fill in? So I'm here as the fill-in. But I want to talk a little bit about the second largest school district
in
the state.
I'm glad that you guys didn't trade that.
Yeah, we didn't trade that. You don't want me delivering babies, Mr. Chair. I had a hard enough time being in the room when my kids were born. So, Salem-Keizer, let me go a little bit of the demographics of the district that you're sitting in today. And a lot of people don't realize how big our school district actually is. We have 41,099 students as of October of this year, one shy of 42,000 students. We have about 172 square miles of our district that covers Marion and Polk County. We are a large geographic district, and people don't realize actually how far our boundaries go. We have 65 schools, and that includes our charters and our alternative programs within the school district. And let me talk a little bit about our student population, which I think a lot of people don't realize the population that Salem-Keizer actually serves. And I'm going to give you a historical perspective. I'm going to go back 10 years and talk about where we were and what we look like today, because our district has shifted dramatically in the last 10 years. So in 2003-2004, our percentage of Hispanic students in our district was 22%. We are now at over 40% of Hispanic students in our school district. Multi-ethnic students who identified themselves, we were at 4%. We're now at 5%. We are a minority-majority school district now in Salem-Keizer. 10 years ago, we were at about 61% of our students identified themselves as Caucasian. We're under 50% now. Back in 2003-2004, 42% of our kids were identified in poverty. We're now at 60% of our students identified as poverty. We have the largest number of students in the state that are ELL served of any school district. Not the largest percentage, but the largest number. Of our ELL students currently receiving services in our school district, we're over 7,800 students that are receiving ELL services. Our special education population, while it hasn't grown dramatically as Portland, we do have specialized programs within our district boundaries that make it unique to our high cost special education programs. So it is one of the issues that Salem-Keizer does face. And I don't mean to say that this is any different than any of your school districts, but it's on a larger scale. And you can move one of these kids into Marshfield or into Ben Lapine or into one of your school districts, Senator Beyer, and it has dramatic impacts. But when you see the concentration of these kids into our school districts, it really impacts our ability to provide services to them and the rest of our kids in our school district. One of the unique things for Salem-Keizer that I don't think any other school district in the state suffers from is our inability to raise property taxes on some of the largest buildings that we have within our district boundaries. You're sitting in one of them, and if you look up and down the mall, each and every one of those very large office buildings that are state-owned, we don't have the ability to collect property taxes on. We don't have the ability to collect property taxes on the facility across the street either. I'm not saying that's a bad thing. I'm just saying it's unique being the state capital. And while it's nice to have the steadiness of the jobs of state employees, it's not an economic growth where industry comes in and provides higher wage jobs for us. So we are somewhat tax property poor in this city because of our inability to raise that. We did pass a bond, as Bobby mentioned, in 2008 for $242 million, which at that time was the largest bond ever passed in the state of Oregon. Our actual need at that time, identified by our community group, was over $527 million. So we were able to get about half of that, and we came up with a list, and we triaged it and said, where do we need the most we could do? So we built a new middle school in West Salem, because we had the largest middle school in the state at Walker Middle School at the time. We now have two comprehensive middle schools. We built four new elementary programs to deal with the growth that we were seeing in our school district, and we went through and did renovations and repairs. But we still have in our school district today over $500 million in need in renovation and repair within our school districts. So as Bobby mentioned, we really need the state to help out and help with the bonding capacity. You do it for the higher ed system, you do it for community colleges. We think it's an opportunity for the state to help out. One of the things I want to make sure that you understand, we appreciate the investment that you as a legislature made last biennium in our schools. The amount of increase that you gave us helped us out dramatically. And one of the things we always hear, and it's and we're doing this in Salem-Keizer, is in an effort to bring back our career and technical education. The amount of money you gave us last biennium over the previous biennium was about $9 million more dollars for the Salem-Keizer School District. Let me give you a little bit of perspective on that. We wanted to add a new, brand new CTE program here, and thankfully, we had a very good benefactor within this city who gave us $9 million to start a CTE program. He bought us a building. He's renovating the building, and he's putting materials in that facility so we can add CTE programs for our students. And we're going to make it a center where we're going to send the kids from our six comprehensive high schools to. We're going to put English programs in there. We're going to put math programs in there. But to build back the CTE programs that we had cut over the last decade cost us $9 million. Luckily, We had a benefactor, and everybody I tell that story to says, can you send them to my school district? It has been a huge boon to us. Larry Tokarski with Mountain West Investments here is the gentleman who helped us out. He's done fantastic work for us, but that's the scale of programs you're talking about in a district our size. The amount you gave us an increase was fantastic. We used it for a variety of things. We lowered our class size by 2 students in K through 3. We bought new technology to do the Smarter Balance Assessment. And we upgraded our middle school social studies curriculum so that our textbooks didn't have Ronald Reagan as president anymore. However, if you look at CTE programs, it cost us $9 million to build this new program. We needed to look at the overall need of the school district. So I will tell you that the need is there. The investment that you made was wise, and we continue to seek that additional investment this next biennium to help these 3 school districts and the 125,000 students they serve, but also the rest of the state as well.
Mr. Chairman and committees of the members of the committee, my name is Leanne Larson, and I'm a locally elected school board member at Beaverton. I also sit on the OSB Board of Directors as a representative from Washington County, and I'm here with my colleagues to tell you a little bit about my district and some of the unique issues that we face. Beaverton is not the same Beaverton that it was 10 years ago. We are just shy of 40,000 students. We're actually at 39,088. We have 51 schools. 33 of those are elementary. 8 are middle, 5 are comprehensive high schools, and 5 are option schools. Our population is 49% of students of color, our largest being Hispanic, Latino, Latina, and our second being Asian population. We have 94 different languages spoken in our school district. 38% of our students qualify for free and reduced lunches. 12.5% are special ed students, and we have the highest number percentage of homeless students in the state. We top out at over 1,300 homeless students. As you can imagine, these demographics provide a myriad of opportunities and challenges for our district. So I want to share with you 3 areas of immediate concern for our district. First of all, funding. No one likes to talk about budgets, but for me, that's where the rubber meets the road as a school board member. The numbers that came out of the governor's budget last week were, frankly, disappointing. 6.9 is a budget cut to Beaverton. It could mean teacher staff layoffs. It could mean higher class sizes, fewer school days, and a possible elimination of valuable programs. I don't like doom and gloom messages, but that's the reality in Beaverton. We spent our state funds last year, and we do appreciate the additional funds that were given. We have a local option levy, thanks to our supportive community, and we spent those funds hiring teachers, reducing our class sizes last year, and making strategic investments to ensure the academic progress of our students. And frankly, we're making some headway. So the governor's budget would be a step backwards to us, and it isn't the right thing for our students. We need to reach at least 7.5 to fund the status quo and full day K. Anything above that, 7.8, 7.9, we would gladly be thrilled for strategic investment and improvements, not just for our students, but for the students across the entire state. The second area that I want to talk about is instructional time. I'm sure you've heard the appalling statistics, but I think they merit being repeated. An Oregon K-12 student attends 1 year less of school than our counterparts across the U.S. And even more horrific, our students are attending 1.5 years less of school than our neighbors in the state of Washington. We know that time in school correlates to student success. And we need to begin to invest our dollars in more instructional time. I'm not talking about reassigning the weights in our state school funding formula, but I am making an appeal to increase the overall pot of money. Don't dilute the pot by adding more mandates or reassigning the existing funds. We need to maintain our local control to make the strategic choices within our own districts. But I am asking if we could increase the state fund, state school fund, it could equate into more instructional time. having more dollars for more learning time, we could provide a more well-rounded education, adding social studies classes at the middle school, PE, arts, music, and more individualized instructional time for our students that need it. Thirdly, I want to touch on career technical education, as Jim did. If Beaverton is to graduate 40-40-20 students, we need a robust commitment from the state in the area of CTE. During the Great Recession, these were some of the first programs that we had to eliminate. We need to stop dabbling in CTE and start making an intentional investment for our students. We estimate about 60% of our Beaverton students should be on a CTE pathway, not just in a CTE class. We have some excellent examples of what we're doing in Beaverton. We've got some wood shop at Aloha, early college at PCC, culinary arts at Westview High School, and health careers at Beaverton. But it's only scratching the surface, and it only serves a small population of our student body. Thank you. As you know, there are so many great living wage CTE careers out there that could become possibilities for our students if we would only invest in making these available for them. An investment in CTE is an investment in our state's economy. Thank you for the opportunity to share my heart and my district with you. I count it an honor to be on the school board and help our students succeed. I appreciate your service in the legislature, and I trust that in the upcoming session you're going to keep in mind the needs of Beaverton students as you make difficult choices that will impact their education. Together, I believe we can make a better education for all the students in Oregon, which will allow them to compete globally. Please invest our state dollars in education. Our students deserve it, as they are truly the promise of Oregon.
Thank you. I think I see about 25% of the state school budget in just your three districts, and my mental math is sound. It's hard in the legislature for a lot of people who are not from Beaverton or Portland, Salem-Keizer, to see the difficulty there, especially, as you know, Jim, when we deal with these rural, small, tiny schools who say, as a woman from Paisley did in the last session, that they're used to having 10 or 15 kids in a classroom, and that because of the budget situation, they're almost up to 20 per classroom. And I explained that parents in Beaverton would do backflips to get down to 20.
Yes, we do.
And I would love it if everybody in the legislature, everybody in Oregon, understood that there are difficulties in large school districts with 90 languages in one district, and difficulties in small districts, some of which only have a handful of students in the entire district. Mm-hmm. And it makes it very difficult when students have to bus 70 miles one way to school. And you know, it's all very expensive, for one thing.
Yes.
And so I don't think anybody disagrees with the need to re-up and do better with the funding of big and small schools. Senator Roblin.
Yeah, I was just going to say, the other thing that the large school districts do, for those of us that were smaller and some that are even smaller, is they provide a lot of expertise. And there have been different times through the history of Oregon when we weren't having as much opportunity with State Department of Education, that we look to these three districts for the guidance and help in understanding things. And they've always been there. I mean, we've sent teachers to every one of those districts at different times to get extra training, and they've opened their doors when they're doing training to those of us in small places, and we would never have been able to have those experiences had it not been for these districts. So I think people forget that sometimes, and I will say that it is uniquely different when you get the really small schools, where when you start dividing it up by person, there's no money. It's so small that it doesn't do anything for anybody. And the converse side, when you get so big, you forget. I'm surprised at the 350, so I really appreciate that. I would have expected that if I really thought about it, because they all come because they're going to go to OHSU, those kids, mm-hmm. or they're going to go to one of those other places. We end up sending them up, and for a while we have some relationship. I mean, Portland really worked hard at trying to let us keep our students, so you try to be there, but it doesn't work over time, and eventually the parents move, and then they're Portland's. But I will tell you, you get one of those in our small districts, I can't imagine 350, because I know what one did to us, you know. And they are unique situations. So I think it's really good that we're having this conversation to remind us. And it is always surprising to hear that Salem-Keizer is the second biggest, because it was never in my comprehension that it was. It's always been Beaverton that I was always thought was. So that's thank you for that.
Chair Haas and Senator, thank you for the comments about the high-cost special needs kids. And the one thing I just wanted to remind folks is we will spend the money and support those children absolutely, positively, regardless of whether you give us the funding. The folks who suffer are the rest of our students, because we will provide those services. So,
yeah.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I would offer up, when the session gets going and you want to see a public-private partnership on how to build a career technical education program, we will take you out to the facility and show you that. We are in the midst of the remodel of that, and the one thing I can say is the Salem-Keizer School District has not spent $1 on it yet. Our private partner has stepped up to the plate to recognize the fact that we have cut those programs so dramatically and that we need a comprehensive career technical education. And as I've always said, every district I tell that story to, they want Larry Tokarski to move to their school district and make that investment.
Yeah.
But I will say it's a long-term project with our private partner. We are agreeing to operate it and continue to grow it. Eventually, he's going to give us that building and the facility over time. So it is a huge gift to our school district. But I encourage you, if you'd like to come out and see what we're doing, we can take this committee during the regular session on a field trip to show you that program.
Yes, we need about 197 Larrys.
So he hasn't given it to you yet, so that means he's also paying property tax on it for you.
That's true.
Well, there's no doubt that additional funding is a necessary length in the school years. Yeah. But there are other things besides money that should be able to help the equation. And it might be premature to get into that today, but there is some work going on within the formula to make it more efficient and more fair. And so I hope you will all participate in those discussions as well.
And, Mr. Chairman, we have. The other thing I would say that would help our school districts out, one of the things we have a really hard time finding, you heard Bobby talk about the number of languages they have in Portland, how many Beaverton has. We have over 60 different languages. We have a really hard time finding certified teachers who speak those languages. Hispanic, we have a hard time filling those ELL teacher spots, but we are a growing population within our school district of Marshallese students.
Mm-hmm.
And trying to find someone certified in some of the languages that you've heard about is really, really difficult. We'd like to work with you and with TSBC to get some of those folks certified so that we can bring them into our schools and be able to provide the language services to groups that we just can't find folks who speak those languages within our existing teacher corps.
I didn't know there was a Marshallese language.
Ms. Chairman, Senator Cruz, neither did I.
They're Americans. We know that.
And our curriculum director came to us and said, we have a growing population of Marshallese students, and they do have a dialect and a language, and we need to provide it in those language skills to them.
And they can come to this country anytime they want, because they're already Americans.
That's correct. So we would like to work with you on loosening up some of those issues around licensure for some of those languages that we just don't see a significant concentration.
Yeah,
I would say that there's a similar licensure issue around career technical education teachers. Mm-hmm. It's really, really hard to find them, and any way to streamline that process would be enormously helpful as well.
Senator Byer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, just I want to thank you all for the time you put in as volunteers. We understand that part pretty well. But I am curious, because I've got you here, if you know, what is your average class sizes in the primary grades in the three districts?
I'll take the first shot at that, because we just got a report at that. So, Mr. Chairman, Senator Byer, as I said, we use part of the money you gave us to lower our elementary class size by about 2 students in grades K through 3. So if you took a look at our comprehensive elementary schools across our district, I think our average class size right now is in the 28 to 29. Now, that's average. We have some that are more than that, and we have some that are less than that. It depends on the school, where you go, average, and what it takes a look. I can tell you in my daughter's elementary school here in Salem-Keizer, Liberty Elementary, we have class sizes out there that exceed 30 students in those grades, which I think if you talk to those classroom teachers, and Senator Roblin, you know this from being in buildings, is difficult to manage at best.
With the increased funding that Portland Public Schools got last year, we were able to add 200 teachers, and we also added 2 days back to the school calendar, which was just huge. We also decreased our high school counselor to student ratio. We try to have a hard cap at kindergarten of 25, and beyond that, we're typically between 25 and 30, 32. We certainly have classes above that.
In Beaverton, our elementary are in the high 20s, but we have some high school classes that are up in the 40s and 50s.
Mr. Chair, as I think probably most of us did, I spent a couple of days in elementary classrooms, spent half a day, and frankly, the ones arriving, the teacher doing an amazing job, and I think the one that I remember standing out in South Eugene was she had a class of 30, and that day there were 28. She did a marvelous job, and I have no idea how those kids ever get an education.
Senator Cannon.
Well, I want to thank you all for being here as well. And I also want to thank you for your efforts and for your financial support of the PERS case. I think that's been very critical. And I wanted to note for you all that I think everybody up here is very supportive of trying to find more revenue. But I also wanted to share with you the same message that I've shared with the unions and others, and that is that because of policies that Oregon and our federal government have pursued, it has affected significantly the funding of our K through 12 higher ed community colleges. And the delay in creating jobs, for instance, on the coast, that's been delayed several years and it's finally getting going. But what we need is support from Oregonians and from people who have a vested interest in more taxpayers. Because 50% of our budget goes to education, we need people to be advocates for job creation and getting people back to work, because 9% of every of their income is going to go to the state, and 50% of that is going to go to education. And so I just wanted to share with you that your advocacy of education is awesome. But I think we need more advocacy of helping create the revenue. And the best way to do that is through job creation, through just raising taxes on this gentleman who is giving you $9 million and clearly is a one percenter. How is that helpful to raise his taxes? Because he's already investing in the community and probably paying far more, quite frankly, in his investment than he would in taxes. And our policies are just shifting those people to other states instead of keeping that that revenue source and that community source here in Oregon. So I just wanted to share that with you and hope that you'll be helpful in our efforts to create more private sector jobs all over the state, but ultimately is a win for education.
Senator, one of the reasons that I specifically mentioned the idea of your supporting us with matching funds for capital facilities bonds is there are districts across the state who have huge facilities needs. And when you go out for a bond and you pass a bond, you're creating jobs. And those jobs are local. They can't be outsourced, and they create income taxes. And it is a way for us to partner together. I understand that you're talking beyond, above and beyond that, but that is one specific way that we can partner together. And our local communities are stepping up. And it would make a huge difference to have the state do some sort of matching dollars to incent us to step up even more locally. So.
All right, well, thank you for this presentation. I do want to get closer to this language, this flexibility on that, the Marshallese situation. It's too bad that they closed in the Marshall High School in Portland, because we could have sent them all there. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Return on investment.
Okay, we're going to go into our LC introduction. Yeah. So I will open up a work session, and before we actually vote, let's go through some of those bills. Do you have that list? Okay. We talked already with Hilda on LC 274. That's what that one is. I want to spend 30 seconds on the community college bill. That is LC 1837. We spent almost every interim education hearing this last year on this issue, and this essentially says that tuition will be paid at community college for high school graduates from Oregon within certain criteria. There will be a copay involved for these students, and there's some other rules that go along with that, and it will be required that it be the last dollar in. So after Pell Grants and Opportunity Grants, the state will pick up the difference, and so we're going to introduce that one as a committee bill. It will likely, if received positively, go to Ways and Means, and I wish Oregon could have been the first state to do a free community college, but Tennessee did that, and in some ways that's very helpful, because we can see what they did, and if you Google up some of those news stories on when they started doing that earlier this year, they are some of the most heartwarming stories I've seen, because the response was overwhelming. Students that did receive Pell Grants and could have gone anyway but didn't were nudged to go forward, and it really seemed to help that state's mojo. And I would hope that the same thing could be done here. Again, I think that is low-hanging fruit on our way to 40-40-20. So that's LC 1837 I wanted to highlight for you. I also, there's also an old favorite here that Senator Cruz and I have become close to, and that's CPR training in schools. It's a little bit different than the one we've talked about before, but we're going to hear that again and discuss it. And there is a, what I would describe as a hairy technical bill that I'd like to call Dan Gilbert up from LC to go over. It is really a cleanup bill from the higher education restructuring we've done in the last couple of sessions, and in particular to the Senate Bill 270, which gave universities the ability to create their own boards. Welcome, Dan. If you want to give us the reasons we're doing this and what we're trying to clean up. And
Chair Hess, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dan Gilbert, and I'm a deputy legislative counsel. So as Chair Hess was mentioning, I'm coming here to just briefly talk about LC 1838. Right now you have a two-page placeholder bill in front of you. The current bill, one of the reasons I'm here is the current working draft bill is about 385 pages, so it is a large bill. But as Chair Hess mentioned, it's essentially a cleanup bill based on work we've done in previous sessions, especially Senate Bill 270. What the bill does is it will remove all statutory references to the Oregon University System and the State Board of Higher Education, and it will fix certain statutory references to Oregon State University and to the technical and regional universities. So contextual background, in Senate Bill 270 in 2013, we did several things. Among the main things we did was we removed University of Oregon and Portland State University from the Oregon University System by granting them independent governing boards. We gave Oregon State University the option of remaining in the Oregon University System or forming its own independent, its own institutional governing board. And we developed a process and a time frame, which was then amended in 2014 through House Bill 4018, by which the regional and technical universities could leave the Oregon University System and obtain their own institutional governing board. What happened was that Oregon State University opted almost immediately to have its own board, which started operating on July 1st, 2014, along with the boards for University of Oregon and Portland State University. Over this past summer, each of the four technical and regional universities also opted for and was approved to receive its own board. And each of those boards are scheduled to become operational on July 1st, 2015. What this means is that as of July 1st, 2015, the Oregon University system, including the Chancellor's Office and the State Board of Higher Education, will have no remaining authority or responsibility. And without a cleanup bill, this means that our current higher education statutes will be largely unintelligible. You know, you'll have ORS 351.011, which will state that the Oregon University system consists of the following universities, and it will be, and that list will be blank. And then you'll have ORS 351.015 that says that the State Board of Higher Education exists to govern, set policy, and manage the affairs of the universities within the Oregon University system. So as neither the Oregon University system nor the State Board of Higher Education have any responsibility or authority, those two statutes should be repealed to reflect the current governance of higher education in Oregon. Unfortunately, those are not the only references to OUS or the SBHE in statute. Our office has located 369 statutes that reference these. And each of these statutes has to be individually examined with a determination made as to whether the statute itself should just be repealed, the reference to OUS or the SBHE should be removed, or simply removed, or the reference to OUS or the SBHE should be replaced with a new entity. And we're currently in the process of doing this and figuring out which ones can be easily fixed as a clear policy determination has already been made and which ones will need subsequent policy determinations. And it just takes a little bit of time. In addition, we do need to fix certain references to Oregon State University and the truths that are currently in statute to ensure that the university's governing boards have the authority promised to them. It was done somewhat awkwardly in Senate Bill 270 in sections 156 to 165A, because it was unclear whether or not these universities would ultimately leave the Oregon University system and get their own boards. You know, for example, Section 165 lists a series of 18 statutes and states that if Oregon State University chooses to have a governing board, the university will act independently with respect to each of these statutes rather than under the direction or control of the State Board of Higher Ed. And each of those statutes just has to be amended to make that clear now.
Thank you. And I shouldn't say this, but when we passed that bill in this committee, many of the changes that he's working on to clean up were changes that were made in Ways and Means. And, but I know, seriously, Dan has been putting in a lot of waking hours on this. There's not a lot of great policy changes here, but just a huge cleanup document. It'll be hundreds of pages long, and that's what's in this bill, Senator Beyer.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate the good work that he's doing and will be doing, but I would guess that this won't be the last time we have to deal with this.
Right. Were you intimating that Ways and Means did some policy?
I've heard rumors. They're from time to time.
Oh, yes. Okay. Yes. Sometimes they have to, I guess.
And that will never happen. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, gentlemen, I think that clears our calendar for today.
Nope.
Yeah,
after we vote.
Oh, yeah.
We're in work session. Yep.
Chair House, I move the following LCs be introduced as committee bills. LC 274, dated 12-9-2014. LC 1713, dated 12-9-2014. LC 1833, dated 12-5-2014. LC 1837, dated 12-9-2014. LC 1838, dated 12-4-2014. LC 2233, dated 12-9-2014. And LC 2779, dated 12-9-2014.
Senator Knoak moves the following LCs be introduced as committee bills: LC 274, LC 1713, LC 1833, LC 1837, LC 1838, LC 2233, LC 2779. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, these bills will be introduced as committee measures. Thank you. It's been a good year. Interim, we covered a lot of ground. I look forward to working with all of you in the coming session. We are adjourned.
Nicely done. That's some good work. Nicely done. That's some good work.